was going to say, if I'm not in a radius of a flat, why?
You from Loserville?
Yeah, legit.
Nice book, idiot!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Out of Print, a literary podcast hosted by myself, Emmeline.
Me, Alice.
And myself, Sophie.
And today, Alice is taking the wheel.
I'm taking the
wheel. Driving us home.
I'm driving you home. We're all very sleepy.
We're a bit grumpy.
We're all a bit grumpy.
The PMS came.
Everyone's feeling a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah, I'm coming off the back of a 5-day bender, so serotonin is seriously depleted after binge drinking. Yeah. Who knew that that would make you feel
crazy?
Hopefully this will be a little bit of a pick-me-up.
A boost.
A little bit of a boost. It's like a slightly serious topic, but also one that I think we can have a bit of fun with, obviously, sensitively. And before I launch
into fun. Sensitively having fun.
Before we launch into it, though, how is everyone besides feeling low? How's everyone's weekend? I guess because it's a Monday and we normally record on a Friday. So
yeah,
we've all come in with Monday energy instead of Friday energy.
Yeah, it's very grey. To jump in with a gripe, I know we normally start off with a fun story, but I'm going to start off with a complaint. My least favourite type of person... You both look nervous.
It's not going to be offensive.
It's a bold statement.
It's going to be like, it's you.
Yeah. Is people who walk down the street, particularly in London, reading a book.
Who have you seen doing that?
I saw three people over the... Don't tell me that you do that.
Every now and then.
That's so crap.
I know.
That's so crap.
Okay, not down the street, but I do it walking from tube station to tubes. As in, like, you know, if you have to change on the... I know,
because it's absolutely absurd.
I know.
You get in my way, and it's incredibly performative.
Well, I don't do it in a performative way, because... no, I actually don't, because I almost think it's a bit embarrassing. But it's like, often, got shit to read, like, on the go, or if I'm going somewhere, or, like, I need to, like... top up notes about something.
I'm pertaining to like a novel.
Yeah, I've done that.
Oh god.
Alice, you're right. I am Sophie's least favourite type of person.
Yeah.
That is me.
That's good. Let's bring the energy and let's harness that.
Let's have a fight. Yeah.
But I understand that it's annoying and I don't do it habitually. And actually one of my least favourite things, so this makes me a hypocrite, is when people walk really slowly. And I'm like, I got places to be.
Yeah, It's just like, the reason why it's in my head is I saw someone walking down Oxford Street, which for anyone who doesn't know, is like an absolute hell site in London that people who live in London try and avoid because it's incredibly busy. And a guy reading, I don't know, I was going to say Harry Potter. I don't think it was.
It'll be like Tolstoy.
It's something like annoying, like Gravity's Nabokov. Rainbow. Yeah, something
Some
like
Russian.
That.
Gravity's Rainbow? Is that Mario Kart round? Rainbow Road.
Gravity's
He's
Rainbow.
Rainbow Road.
He's studying.
Gravity's Rainbow is a Thomas Pynchon novel, and it's like notoriously...
That's really embarrassing. I didn't know that.
Notoriously, like, difficult read. Like, I think I tried to read about two pages, and I was like, I'm actually not very clever. And I just stopped.
Okay, my only defence for this situation is that... Surely, reading a book in the middle of the street has some kind of whimsical charm compared to someone that is deep in the perils of the iPhone.
I think both people should be rounded up and just shoved off the street.
But we all walk around looking at our phones. We do that.
Only if I'm looking at maps.
I only have it for maps because I'm very nervous about it getting taken.
I am nervous about that too.
Or I'm texting someone about where I'm trying to meet them and stuff.
Yeah.
There's something about... trying to force whimsy on me when you're actively in my road that really sort of brings out like a kind of school bully sort of energy.
Like, that's you want to call them a nerd and
give them a wedgie
and like force, like knock the book out of their hands and onto the floor and then stomp on it.
Watch yourself.
I do realize that. I mean, also we should say that for everyone listening, like, I think this is a sort of city unique experience, because if you're on a quiet road in the middle of the countryside reading a book, like, I mean, I don't know what...
I have less issue with that.
Yeah.
But I also just don't go to the countryside point blank. I'm I'm the definition of a city slicker.
You are.
If I'm not... no, I'm actually not going to say that. That was going to be really... I was going to say, if I'm not in a radius of a flat, why? I don't want to be there.
You're not visiting me and Emmeline in our hometown.
No. But your hometowns have lots to offer. You know, yeah. good pubs. Well, and scampi fries.
Let's not include that. No shade to Huddersfield.
No. What was it you said when you were little?
My dad did a quiz at my birthday, which included some of the more choice phrases of mine. Actually, Sophie, I don't know if you were there at this
No,
point.
I wasn't.
There was some pretty... And he said... it was multiple choice. He said, Emmeline once described her hometown, Huddersfield, as a dump, a shithole, or the like...
Loserville.
Which
is my favourite. Loserville.
What do you think?
So, I think that's incredibly good, chap.
What do you think? Well, which one do you think I called it?
Give me the options again.
It was a...
Shithole.
A dump or Loserville.
I could see you saying a dump.
It was a shithole.
It was a shithole. Yeah.
I probably said all three. Probably, it could have been any age.
Yeah, fair.
Because I was imagining you said it when you were like a six. Preteen, and therefore it would have been Loserville.
Loserville.
Because it's so American,
also,
yeah.
But also just like bring back saying something's Loserville.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a great phrase.
You're going to Loserville.
Yeah.
Or like putting ville onto the end of a like word. An insult. Used to be, yeah, like...
Slagville.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that one. It's strong.
No, it's good. Twerp. Calling someone a twerp.
Twerp. Yeah.
Quiet worm.
Quiet worm.
That's
quiet
your
worm
favorite. Strong.
Yeah.
I really like motherfucker. I say it quite a lot. And it's just like so offensive.
What, saying motherfucker?
It just sounds good. Like
it's quite American as well.
Yeah.
It's motherfucking.
Yeah.
It sounds really crap in my accent. I can't say it.
Go on. Just
motherfucker. It sounds silly.
It's more sing-songy,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
With that gorgeous Scottish lilt attached to it.
It sounds quite nice, actually. Well, this is good. It's good to have some clapbacks in the bank for when we encounter a performative male.
Oh, tell us
more.
Or
Emmeline reading in the street.
For when we encounter
If I
Emmeline.
Get, like, verbal abuse on the street now, I know who to... It's going to be you.
Nice book, idiot!
You from Loserville?
Yeah, legit.
So this leads nicely into what we're talking about today, which is a pretty big, meaty topic. I think I'm summarising it as... the baby girlification of the straight man, which is an umbrella that kind of encompasses all manner of sins, from soft boys to men written by women to what we've now landed at, which is the 2020s performative male, which everyone's been covering.
Also known as
year.
A baby girl.
Or are they known as a baby girl as well?
Or a matcha male.
A matcha male.
I haven't heard that. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I suppose we're here to learn. But I thought a baby girl was a performative male. You say they're different.
I feel like it's like when women call their boyfriends baby girl.
Oh, he's so baby girl.
That's part of the...
Yeah.
It's less like... You wouldn't call... The men aren't baby girls. But the men who are... being ascribed terms of femininity and infantilization are being referred to as baby girl.
Okay, strong. I'm on board for this, Alice. I'm excited. What's the text that you've brought in?
So I've brought in Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. And are you guys familiar with the plot?
Not even slightly.
I am, but only from seeing bits of the film, not from reading the book. Sue me.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very sort of, I'd say it's canonical both in the cinematic and the literary sense, because I think the film's quite famous. Ira Levin also wrote Stepford Wives.
Okay.
Oh, really? I didn't familiar. Know that. Yeah. I've seen the film with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah. the film, the Stepford Wives was one of my favourite films growing up. So he was writing a lot in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and... both Rosemary's Baby and Stepford Wives are satires about the sort of plight of mid-20th century suburban womanhood. So Rosemary's Baby, I've taken as an very, very extreme example of a performative male.
Okay.
And this I'm hoping will kind of like give contrast to the kind of banal, labubu-wearing, Nabokov-reading performative male of 2025. Yep. Basically, the plot of this book is there's a woman called Rosemary, is a housewife, soon-to-be stay-at-home mum, who's married to a man called Guy, and he is an actor. And basically, they move into this famous building in Manhattan, and it turns out their neighbors are these like kind of weird old people who are part of a coven.
Okay.
So they're living next door to witches. Obviously, none of this becomes like apparent until the end of the book. Like, this is all major plot spoilers. But also, it's quite like famous text, so like, I feel like people generally know.
So it came out in the 60s, if you've not read it yet.
Yeah, if you've not read it yet. And the film came out in like the 90s or something. So yeah. So basically, Guy, in order to accelerate his acting career, he gets the coven. He makes a deal with the witches next door, who are worshippers of Satan specifically, to make his rival go blind so that he can no longer perform in the play that Guy wants to perform in.
Of all the things to entertain a coven for, getting the lead in a play.
Yeah, so lame.
Literally, yeah. So he wants the lead in a play. Yeah. And to do this, he trades off that basically he will allow the coven to impregnate his wife, Rosemary, with Satan's baby.
Oh, shit. This doesn't seem like a good deal.
No.
Because it's kind of his baby, too. I mean, he doesn't see it that way.
I mean, you know, ask for something like a tail or something cool.
He gets to be the lead in a play in order to have the child of the devil. That's
like the literal son of the Antichrist.
That's crazy. I feel like they could have found a better deal for him to do. Do you know what I mean?
Maybe just be the better actor.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because he's, you know, he's just trying to get a break. He's trying to get his lucky break.
Okay, got you.
So that's kind of what he's gunning for. And then obviously throughout the novel, there's a lot of suspense and everyone's gaslighting Rosemary. They're like, you're fine, girl. She's like, why am I in so much pain? I shouldn't be in this much pain. And they're like, nah, it's normal.
Mm.
Which is also like a very interesting metaphor for, I don't know, like endometriosis or PCOS or how women's health issues are dealt with in general.
Mm.
I don't know if Levin was doing that knowingly, but I thought that was quite an interesting, like when I was reading it, I was like, oh, well, that sounds like endometriosis.
Yeah.
And then eventually everything comes to light and she realizes that Guy was lying to her and playing a very convincing part as the dutiful, lovely, metropolitan, kind of a little bit woke husband. I mean, obviously woke in the sense of like in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So like, seems like a nice guy, but then inevitably he has put his career and his needs way, way, way before her needs.
Okay. This sounds like a super interesting text. And yeah, I see where you're going with the woman has not only been impregnated with the spawn of Satan, but also with his desires and career, and she's having to carry that to term.
She's the canvas onto which he has projected his artistic and creative endeavours, which he obviously wants above all else. And like I said, this is a very extreme example of the performative male, and it is a little bit of a shoehorn, mostly because we just liked the idea of calling an episode Rosemary's Baby Girl. But you know what? We've kind of got here.
We'll make a t-shirt out of it.
Yeah, we'll make a t-shirt out of it. And it is also just interesting the way Ira Levin deals with kind of femininity and womanhood. I think if he were writing today, or if we met this man and he was in his 20s and we went on a first date with him and he told you he was writing a book about the horrors of pregnancy or the horrors of being a Stepford wife in the suburbs,
I'd be like, yeah, you can impregnate me.
I'd be thinking that's performative as
oh, I thought that was like, okay,
but I'm
okay,
a cynic. Yeah.
Okay, no, you're so correct.
Yeah, but this is the thing.
This is why I'm single.
No. This is the important discussion, which is how do you deal with that? Does it immediately raise a red flag? And you know, it's like, why are you trying to comment on women's issues? Are you using this to kind of perform, or are you someone that's genuinely aligned to the cause? And then you have cynics like Alice being like, fuck off. Do you know what I mean? So this is why it's useful that all three of us are in this room with different views.
Yeah.
On reflection, I do totally agree with you. And I think that there is, it's when someone takes, and this happens in all walks of life, but when someone takes someone else's core issue that is related to their identity and their experience of the world and makes it their main problem and thing that they're vocal about, that can be quite a complicated thing to navigate, because it's like it's lots of questions about who has the right to tell certain stories, who has the right to be close to the experience of someone else, and it can come from a really positive place of wanting to support someone else's experience, but it can also take away from their experience if you're the one that is controlling the narrative about it.
I guess, you know, the question is often why, and I think what's interesting about the performative male archetype is that they are co-opting aesthetics with the goal to attract a quote-unquote progressive type of woman. So it's about performing in order to attract a mate. And it's not necessarily about embodying, I don't know, feminism or like being an ally.
Right.
It's how... Yeah, it's like a man wearing a tote bag and a little crop top.
It's an aesthetics issue.
Yeah, it's an aesthetic over a sort of ideological.
Yep.
But then aesthetics are maybe ideological, so it's like, how, where do you separate things?
Yeah,
you
know? Totally.
Obviously, in Rosemary's Baby, Guy is a very extreme example of, you know, he's pretending to be a good husband. He's pretending to be a sort of forward-thinking, mid-20th century man.
Mm.
But he's actually a bastard who's getting his wife pregnant with the literal Antichrist. Obviously, you know, so I want to, like, have a little think about the performative male tropes and how we've evolved to get to this point, because we had the soft boy in the late 2010s, I guess, when we started uni. And I think I definitely encountered my fair share of soft boys. I'm pretty sure you guys did as well.
Yeah.
And they're kind of characterized by, you know, like they wear nail varnish, they have a really niche music taste, they sort of pretend to be emotionally sensitive, and a lot of it's about them sort of being like kind of dark and brooding and artistic, and you know, that's the kind of vibe of the soft boy. And then we sort of evolved from that to the men written by women archetype, which was, I guess, early 2020s.
The yearners. Mm. Like the Sally Rooney archetypes, that the Jenny Han archetypes, the Shondaland, Bridgerton male who are yearners. That's their key sort of, that's the defining feature, is that they pine for women.
Mm. Yeah, and like the sort of wife guy was like a thing around that time as well.
I don't know what the wife guy is.
So this is like a classic man who all he talks about is, I love my wife.
My wife.
And the most famous example of it was this guy called Ned Fulmer, who's on the Try Guys. Do you remember the BuzzFeed's The Try Guys?
I don't know if I'm in this part of the internet.
So basically, when BuzzFeed was this huge multimedia sort of conglomerate, the people who worked there, who wrote the articles, started featuring in web series, and they got really popular. And then there was this popular kind of set of four men who are called the Try Guys. There is a point to this story. I'm not going down a complete rabbit
hole.
You're good. And they all had their different personality types. One was the kind of like nerdy, perpetually single virgin. One was like the kind of tall guy who loved hot dogs. And one was the kind of like cool, like fashion guy.
Sure.
With great hair. And one was the wife guy.
Ah.
And his thing was on every episode. I love my wife. Me and my wife do this, blah, 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 blah. Could not get away from talking about his fucking wife. And then he ended up cheating on her. So this is the classic thing with often the wife guy.
These real people.
These are real people. Oh. These are real men. Oh. And this guy, Ned Fulmer, cheated on his wife, Ariel. They had a podcast together, all this stuff, with an intern who was working at the company, and someone saw them kissing at a concert. And this is why it's really relevant to the discussion around like being performative, is the performative wife guy, famously. And John Mulaney is another famous example.
Yes, yeah.
He's a classic wife guy. Also,
yes,
it's ambiguous. It's implied that there was some sort of crossover between when his last relationship and his next one was ending. But those people who are always banging on about it are often the ones who cheat.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you covering up?
Real life examples of those as well.
Yeah, totally.
They sort of talk the talk, but aren't actually able to or choose not to walk the walk.
Yeah. So they're interested in being perceived
as a wife guy.
It's also interesting that Guy is an actor, I guess, in the one sense, because we're talking about the babyfication of men, and the men that we have most typically as model examples of those are actors, really. They are in sort
like
of...
Paul Mescal.
Paul Mescal, Jacob Elordi, Josh O'Connor, Harris Dickinson.
Yeah.
These men in particular are the ones that are like poster guys for that. All the articles at the moment or in the past few years have been the new type of man.
Mm-hmm.
And that new type of man is kind of, yeah, like the baby girl. So Jacob Elordi is famously almost rarely pictured without a book in his hand.
Yeah.
And a tote bag.
And they all shoot film.
They all shoot film and they all wear cardigans and they all listen to Boy Genius and Clairo and... Yeah.
And I get suckered in every time. Hook, line and sinker. Yeah. Yum, yum, yum.
Do you know what? I don't know if I've ever been with that kind of guy. And I wonder if it's maybe also like as a creative, I'm aware of my own pitfalls in that sense that, you know, I too read on the street. Exception. For some reason, the soft boy is not my type.
Yeah.
Which is not to say I have a good taste in men at all.
I think what's interesting, this is a very quick aside, is that all of those actors that we just listed are really quite classically masculine looking men who are all fairly tall, all fairly built. And it's interesting that they get ascribed the title of soft boy.
Mm.
Whereas if you're a kind of like smaller, maybe with like longer hair or less like a defined jawline, you'd be described as effeminate.
Yeah. Or like rap boy face or like ugly hot. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Have you seen that TikTok of that guy? He's like, why is it ugly hot? Why can it not just be hot? And he's like, why does it have to be? I won't do it justice, but it's funny. It's basically him saying, like, can we not just, like, why does someone have to be ugly hot? Why can't
they
be hot?
Why do we have to ascribe micro categories and micro aesthetics to every single man and every single person or type of person?
Yeah.
And I think this is something that, because my partner definitely ticks a lot of the performative male boxes.
He came around to our house the other day and he had a copy of Normal People and I was like,
oh my and God. He's been reading I Love Dick on the tube a lot recently by Chris Krauss and I'm like, whoa,
he's gonna end up on at Beam Me Up Soft Boy.
And he has
a mustache and he carries a tote
and he has a cardigan
and he wears a tartan jacket
and he loves mutting you out.
Is that performative? I guess it could be, actually.
People who always talk about how much they love eating pussy, that is the number one trait of the performative male.
Yeah, but he doesn't talk about it.
No.
To you guys. Well, I don't think he does. He's too bashful.
Yeah.
I would hate to talk to him about that.
No, like, no. That would be horrible.
No.
But it's an important part of the picture.
It's like I love giving, like female pleasure is so important. And I'm doing an American accent, but it's like, we've got to close the orgasm gap.
And then they never do.
But, you know, like last night we watched a film and then... As I was going to sleep, he was up rage typing like a several hundred word review of the film on his letterbox.
That's another good one, actually.
Yeah. But yeah, it was not a good film. But yeah, he takes his letterbox very seriously. He takes his house plants very seriously. His Spotify playlists. Like, he is very much a performative male. And I make fun of him for it all the time. And he's like, why can't I just like things?
Oh, yeah.
why can't men just like things?
We are setting up a GoFundMe for Alice's boyfriend so he can buy some more tote bags
and books and just like them and not be made fun of. But it is I'm like, you know, I'm making fun of you because it's funny, but also he has always liked those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he does like them genuinely. Like, he's not performatively... reading Sally Rooney on the tube. More broadly, I was thinking a lot about Judith Butler's gender trouble when I was like writing the notes for this, because obviously the core of her argument is that gender is inherently a performance of repeated like speech or aesthetics. Like it is something that we perform.
Yeah.
Rather than a sort of fundamental thing that we're born with.
Yeah.
And that extends as well to the pick me girl.
Yeah.
Because I think with the performative male, I also accuse my partner of being a pick me. I think the two are sort of one and the same.
Yeah, they're counterparts. Yeah.
Yeah. And the pick me girl is like another side of a similar coin where it's obviously women rejecting their femininity.
Mm.
To be the cool girl. Like, you guys are familiar with the cool girl monologue from Gone Girl.
Yeah, iconic.
Where she talks about, I've got a little quote here. She's kind of talking at men
in men in general in this monologue. And it's like, you are not dating a woman. You are dating a woman who has watched too many movies written by socially awkward men who'd like to believe that this kind of woman exists and might kiss them.
Mm.
Which feels akin to the man written by a woman.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah,
archetype
sure.
of yeah, like, yeah. you know, it's like these are constructed.
Yeah.
Expressions of a certain gender, of like a certain norms associated with masculinity and femininity. And obviously the cool girl, she embraces football and hot dogs and giving head. Mm. Like there's a lot of parallels.
On the flip side, I unfortunately was, I don't know if I had a weak moment last summer, but I did get into the thick of the Somewhere I Turn Pretty.
Mm.
Yeah. And I know, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. And within that, I feel like people went crazy for, I'm guessing neither of you seen it.
No.
People went, don't look at me like that, girl. People went crazy for this character, Conrad Fisher, who is the archetypical yearner, who was not chosen at a certain stage by this girl, Belly, and he yearns for her. And there are scenes of him, like, doing the dishes in a very, like, sort of vaguely erotic way, or like, you know, taking her bike and walking with it. All these traits which are now sort of maybe associated with a man who might be a baby girl or a slightly performative male. And people went feral for it. And it's like, I don't know how much of a realistic character this man is. He's like a reformed
a man who does the dishes. Do they?
I haven't met one.
No, it's true.
I don't do them either, so I can't. Like, I can't complain.
What, but like, what does it mean that women are writing male characters who have traditionally sort of, you know, are more domestic and more in the carer role, and then men are kind of obsessed with the idea of the woman who wants to, like. Like you said, eat hot dogs and go to football. It's like, just hang out with your own gender at that point.
Well, also goes back to this debate that we had a few episodes ago about sort of the dating scene at the moment, and a conversation I had with a friend of mine. He was like, you know, I don't want to show up with flowers because I don't want a scene to be like that guy, which is the baby girl guy. But then at the same time, as a woman, I'm like, well, I would love if someone showed up with flowers. It's like this sort of toxic cycle of expectation and reality and performativity, where do people know what they really want in the middle of all that? I'm not sure they do.
My hot take on things is that there is an issue that comes with performance when it's kind of catered and designed purely to kind of entrap, you know, the opposite gender and to lure them in. However, we are living through some deeply scary political times where, so for example, do you guys know who Nick Fuentes is?
I don't know if I do.
American right winger. He has this group of like followers called the Groypers. They are sufficiently right wing that they are describing Trump as being like too liberal. They describe Charlie Kirk as too liberal.
Sure.
And they are the ones pushing the horrible slogan of your body, my choice. So we're in this rise where there's this online group of incels, and it's growing, you know, week upon week upon week, of young men kind of being like, yeah, women shouldn't be at work. They shouldn't be in political positions. They should be in the kitchen, you know, kind of going back to those old school, like, quote unquote, like Christian values.
They
in
shouldn't
the States.
Have a podcast.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I'm like, my point is that, is there an issue with the performative male catering in this way? Yes, there is. But then I think we run the risk of pulling each other apart when actually, like, you know, with the scale back of like DE&I and stuff like that, we're seeing less of the soft boy and we're seeing more of the kind of scary right wing character. By making fun of men for falling into certain stereotypes or aesthetics, are we then pushing them towards somewhere where they do feel a sense of belonging and that they aren't going to get made fun of and that they have a sense of power? That's my question.
And I think if the performativity is not entirely conscious and it's not malicious, then it does no harm.
Yeah.
I'd be inclined to agree with that. And I think as well, like, also to remember that there is, you know, the word soft boy, as far as I understand it, was an evolution of the original term, which was soy boy, which is obviously like a really offensive term of being like oh, well, you're basically a girl. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of my question of, like, yes, it's horrible if someone's kind of posing to you and they're actually secretly, like, dangerous, but you've been brought in on the fact that they've read Bluettes by Maggie Nelson.
Sure. Mm.
But what's the alternative?
And also, yeah, we should never be in a position where we're criticising gender expression or, you know, if it is the case that these men are more comfortable with wearing a crop top and ignoring sort of the codification of gender that we've all sort of learnt by proxy, that's it's a positive thing that people are pushing those boundaries. You know, the fact that also for men that gender expression can be such a smaller box than for women, and I'm being sort of fairly like gender stereotypical here, but you know, no one will bat an eyelid. I'm in a cap and baggy trousers and a Dragon Ball Z jumper today. Whereas if a guy was in here and was wearing a skirt and a crop top and had their nails painted, that would raise more sort of visual questions to people, and you know, we shouldn't be adding to that.
In the defence of the soft boy, when they were, like, painting their nails and stuff like that and, you know, experimenting a little bit more with the kind of rigid confines of masculinity, does that then create a safer space for gender expression going on in, like, the LGBTQ community, for example? And Alice, I know this is something that you wanted to touch on.
Yeah, I think one of the, I guess, strong takes on the baby girlification of the straight man and the sort of, like, performative male as someone who co-opts aspects of femininity and by extension queerness, because I think any kind of deviance against the gender binary, you do sort of enter queer territories. And this person, so they're called Transtender, and they have an amazing Substack, and their Substack is called Transtender. I think she's called Chrissy. She wrote this amazing essay called "Your Straight Boyfriend Is Not Gay."
Okay.
And it was about the sort of like pervasive infantilization, baby girlification of straight men, particularly by their girlfriends, be they straight or bi, but I think particularly bi women trying to sort of like defend their queerness by being like, yes, I'm in a heterosexual relationship, but look how fruity my man is. Like, he wears a crop top, wants a finger up the bum, like, you know, da 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 da, like, and like trying to kind of like, I guess, soften the heterosexual nature of their relationship when in actual fact, you're in a heterosexual relationship, you're straight passing, I'm straight passing, just embrace the privilege that comes with. And it also comes back to the, like, is having a boyfriend embarrassing now? That Vogue article that went viral. It's like this kind of rejection of being attracted to men, and this is a way, kind of making them appear more gay or fruity is a way of sort of dismissing that. So she's trans, for context as well, Transtender. And she wrote this essay, and she made basically what you guys were just saying. I'm going to read this little paragraph out where she's talking about how at least before she could tell if someone was going to call her a transphobic slur by looking at them. But now that so many straight men have co-opted this like sort of like soft boy queerer aesthetic of wearing crop tops and loafers, it's like she doesn't know, you know, like where people stand anymore, like politically. And that's kind of an interesting point. But she says kind of towards the end that we don't need men to abandon the project of manhood. That's a doll's job. And we certainly don't need girlfriends infantilizing them with queer euphemisms to defang their masculinity. Mm-hmm. We need men who role model masculinity that isn't violent and bigoted without annexing them from their wider cohort. So we need men who are good role models without it being like, oh, but they're not like other boys. Like, they're different, they're different. We just need like a overarching positive form of masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, I don't want to fall into the cesspool of beta cook, soy boy, 4chan discourse around the modern emasculated man. But I do think the lack of progressive masculinity has left a cultural vacuum that's been filled with Andrew Tate and incel ideology, exactly like what you guys were saying.
Okay, yeah.
She goes on to say that, you know, too often straight men who reject traditional masculinity, do so as personal vanity projects. So that's where the performative man comes in. Like, are they doing it because they're generally critical and self-aware of their masculinity and the implications of moving through the world as a man? Or are they doing it because it's kind of trendy and cool and it gets you a girl with bangs who, like, reads Joan Didion? Like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'd like to understand your thoughts in a summary. Do we think that men reading Sally Rooney and wearing rings is a bad thing, basically?
I think, you know, I think at least they're trying. And it's hard for me to answer this question objectively without my own politics sort of coming into it. But we saw at the start of 2025, Trump scaled back, you know, DE&I regulations, and people stopped talking about BLM and women in the workplace and neurodivergence in the workplace. And we also saw the drop of the soft boy at that point. And I actually think, for me, as someone who's very left-wing, the soft boy trend was great because it brought with it, you know, useful conversations about gender dynamics and dressing and, like, entering queer spaces and if we're allowed to do that and stuff like that. So I think, you know, if a man's going to make an effort, even if he doesn't do it quite right, I'd rather that than someone who's going to say, you know, your body, my choice.
Yeah. I think that's a fair and nuanced take.
I suppose my understanding of the criticism towards those aesthetics is because they have become associated with a certain type of behaviour, which is seen to be slightly manipulative towards women and to excuse behaviour that is pertains to a kind of toxic masculinity, and it's disguised by this dress. And so I actually do understand the criticism of it and maybe people poking fun of it, because I think that where that comes from is actually a frustration with behavioural patterns that the more extreme examples of that can be associated with. But I do not think that a man carrying a tote bag or a man reading Sally Rooney is inherently wrong in the slightest. In fact, I encourage it. I would like, you know, the more tote bags, the merrier.
Like, and the more books they're reading by women, written by women, then
the more books they're reading by women in the middle of the street to annoy Sophie, the better. So I suppose that's my summary. That's valid.
So as long as they're not co-opting it as an aesthetic to hide shitty behaviour.
That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah, and I think that basically we are, you know, I very much subscribe to Judith Butler's kind of ideology that gender is just like an expression and it's a performance. So whenever we're talking about the performative male, it's like masculinity is performative. Like in every toxic masculinity is performative in a way, you know, in the same way that we're always performing or not performing femininity, or we're rejecting femininity and being pick me girls. Like, it's such a vast and knotty subject. As Shakespeare said, the world's a stage and all the men and women are merely players. So I don't think we can really kind of...
That is such a slay.
Yeah, like it's all a performance.
Well,
everything is.
You only have to look at, you know, the super, like, ultra mega right-wing people in the States who are all out in the forest and, like, filming videos with flannels on, and they're really kind of leaning into that lumberjack aesthetic, even though they all went to Stanford and studied politics and have never done a day of blue-collar work on their life. And as podcaster Caleb Heron points out, that's drag.
Like, yeah, it's all drag. Yeah, it's all drag.
Yeah.
We all, what is it RuPaul says? We all come, we're all naked. Born naked, and the rest is drag.
If you're going to do it well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe it's more drag.
Yeah. That's the takeaway.
I think that concludes the episode.
Thank you so very much, strong. Guys. I'm not as grumpy as I was when
That's
I started.
That's good. Yeah. Me too. Thanks, Queen.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and thank you to the Roundhouse for hosting us.
Big ups to Roundhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.